Today sees the return of our stablemate podcast, Security Bytes. Hosted by Jim Tiller, our group CISO, he talks to security experts from across the industry, bringing you the latest in cyber.
Back then, we saw individuals working airlines who were involved in taking millions of dollars across borders, literally in their backpacks and suitcases. With cryptocurrency, you don't necessarily have to do that. It's not really being used as currency. It's essentially being used as a gold bullion.
Welcome to Security Bytes, a show where we're joined by an industry-leading cybersecurity expert to discuss today's pressing business and technical challenges of security. Join me, your host, Jim Tiller, brought to you by and powered by Nash Square. Let's get started. I'm really excited to introduce a very special guest today. He has more than 30 years experience as an expert interpreter and translator for the Russian language, working on everything from movies and books to collaborating with the FBI and law enforcement agencies around the world on criminal investigations encompassing both physical and cybersecurity domains. He's a world-renowned cyber threat intelligence expert and has worked for such companies like CrowdStrike, Flashpoint, and most recently was a director of cybercrime and underground intelligence for Recorded Future. Currently, he's the president of Constellation Cyber and provides cyber threat intelligence and advisory services to companies and organizations around the world. I'm really, really looking forward to this conversation. I give you Roman Sannikov. How you doing, Roman?
Doing well, Jim. Thank you so much. That was quite an introduction.
We were conversing email and chatting a little bit before we got started, and there's just so much that we can talk about. It's amazing. And I just want to go ahead and set the audience up now that, you know, we can expect more conversations with Roman moving forward because there's just so much to talk about. But I think let's just start with the most obvious piece. You've been doing, you know, Russian translation services for more than 30 years. And for me personally, I always felt the Russian language, even the early days of cyber, I saw it a lot. And I actually, with my daughter, attempted to learn Russian, which I failed miserably. But you've been doing this long before we started talking about cybersecurity and all this kind of stuff. What got you into learning and using Russian language?
Well, as some of you might figure out by my last name, I am a heritage speaker. So I came over to the United States as a young boy in 1979. And so I always kept speaking the language, reading with my family, my parents. And then when I was in college in the late 80s, early 90s was the fall of the Iron Curtain and the fall of the Soviet Union. And it seemed like a really kind of heady time. A lot of people were really looking forward to being able to travel to and potentially do business with this giant new area, this giant new opportunity. Unfortunately, kind of the dark days of the 90s descended, so things didn't go quite as smoothly as a lot of people had hoped. But I think that's one of the reasons I decided to make the Russian language my career at that stage, was because it seemed like there was going to be a lot of opportunity and a lot of potential. So that was the beginning, so to speak.
That was the beginning, so to speak. That's amazing. I think it's one thing to have that as your mother tongue, but also have the ability, like with your family, to stay in practice and then create a profession is really amazing. Now, I mentioned in your introduction, you worked with law enforcement, and I know you have some amazing stories, you know, hopefully we'll be able to get into that. Right. But, I just thought I would say is, you know, some of your thoughts just generally around some of your experiences. And like you mentioned, like with example, with Tank being recently, apprehended, lack of a better term, you know, for me, Zeus was like the big thing of the early 2000s. That's how I know him from that particular distance. But, you know, what kind of experiences, you know, I know you have a ton, but, you know, doing these types of investigations, give me kind of a picture of what that was like when you first started and how it looks like for you today.
You know, it was really interesting. In the kind of early 2000s, when most of this kind of cybercrime, and at that time, a lot of the cybercrime, unfortunately, as it is today, was centered around individuals who spoke Russian. So not all of them were in Russia or from Russia, but it was kind of the Russian was the lingua franca of cybercrime. At that time, I was working as a contractor for the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigations, and we wound up getting a lot of these notifications about young people, J1 students, individuals who came over from the former Soviet Union and would come over here and would be approached by individuals who were running kind of money laundering and cyber theft. And we're using these students as the what they're now called money mules. So individuals who would open up accounts, receive funds, etc. And so a lot of times what would happen is, we'd approach these individuals who really had, at the time, little idea of what it is exactly that they were getting involved in. Maybe they thought it was a little shady, but they probably didn't know the extent of the theft that was happening. They were usually maybe responsible for cashing out, withdrawing, maybe a few thousand dollars worth of funds. And they didn't realize that a lot of this was really only a small part of multi-million dollar theft from companies primarily in the West, United States, Western Europe, etc. There was a case in the late 2000s called RBS WorldPay. And it was a system that was set up for people to receive salaries through this kind of online transfer. And there was, if I remember correctly, there was something like over $9 million were withdrawn from accounts over the course of a long weekend. I believe it was Veterans Day weekend or something like that. And this involved individuals literally standing at ATMs all over the world in over 40 countries, withdrawing something like $500 at a time. And so the masterminds, these cyber criminal masterminds, typically they understand coding, they understand to some extent, but their real brilliance is the organizational aspect of it. They're not the ones that generally write the malware. They maybe will farm that out to a coder or a programmer, but their brilliance is really the organizing all these individuals all over the world and getting them to work in kind of in synchrony and to be able to withdraw or whatever else they're using to monetize the funds, but to ultimately get their hands on the funds. So that was kind of the early days when we would literally go to, Brighton Beach in Brooklyn or some of these other primarily Russian-speaking areas around New York City. And we would, bang on doors and we would get these young kids and we would bring them in and explain to them that they were, doing something illegal. And luckily, the vast majority of these individuals, once I explained to them what they were involved in and what they were facing, not to say that all of them were blameless. I think a lot of them understood that what they were doing was illegal. Maybe they didn't just understand quite the magnitude of what they were doing. Most of them agreed to collaborate. The vast majority of them agreed to collaborate. And in that case, we did something kind of like I think a lot of people will be familiar with from maybe some of the mob movies or something, is you roll people up. So once you have the kind of the low man on the totem pole collaborating with you, then you target their boss, and then you target their boss, etc. And we would continue doing that until we got to a point where we would usually find somebody overseas, usually in the former Soviet Union, although sometimes in other countries as well. And at that time, we would collaborate with law enforcement from these various countries, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Baltic countries, etc. Sorry, I've kind of gone off on a big ramble here.
Love it. No, I think, first of all, I remember that attack. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I actually spoke about it at a couple of events just amazingly about it. And the key thing that comes to mind is one, this is pre-Bitcoin. So you had to monitor, you had to get the cash somehow. Mm-hmm. And these mules, you know, and I dealt with like reshipping stuff like that back in the old days, right? Yep. You know, and I'm sure you're very much involved in the legal, you know, the law enforcement side of that. And it's just so interesting to say is, you have this sort of crime, you know, criminal intent, thinking like a criminal, and the ability to organize that and manifest all that millions of dollars, or however, I think you said it was 9 million, maybe even more across, you know, like you said, 40 plus countries. It's amazing to think about that. I mean, just out of curiosity, so when we speak about like what that happened in the early 2000s is, what does it look like today? I mean, are you seeing more types of that collaboration? Are you seeing, you know, how much time are we interacting with these sort of former bloc nations, as it were?
You know, just to jump back to that particular example that you might find interesting. So the individual who's actually kind of the head of that RBS WorldPay kind of scam or attack was actually a former MVD officer in St. Petersburg, Russia. And one of the reasons that he kind of felt that he could operate with impunity was that he assumed that the investigation would be done by his former colleagues who would give him a heads up. But the investigation was carried out by the FSB instead of the MVD, which is the federal law enforcement. So he actually did wind up getting arrested. I don't think he got quite the amount of time that he should have, but that's a whole different story. But just the fact that at the time he did get picked up because of that. But getting back to your question about what we're seeing now, I think it's interesting. So obviously, cryptocurrency has changed the landscape a bit, because now we don't have to necessarily, the funds don't have to be transferred, wired, bank to bank, although you still see a lot of that. One of the companies I'm actually advising right now specifically focuses on individuals who have funds stolen from their bank accounts and wired the old-fashioned way to money mules in various, usually countries in Eastern Europe or Western Europe, and then kind of cashed out, and sometimes even physically taken across borders. But back then, we saw, in some cases, we saw individuals working airlines who were involved in taking millions of dollars across borders, literally in their backpacks and suitcases, et cetera. Obviously, with cryptocurrency, you don't necessarily have to do that. But still, even cryptocurrency is only secure to an extent, because one of the problems with cryptocurrency on a larger scale is that it's not really being used as currency. It's essentially being used as a gold bullion. Either it's investment or it's being used to facilitate something illegal. So you're not really going to go into the store and buy groceries with cryptocurrency, or fill up your gas tank, or pay for your hotel with cryptocurrency. So at some point, the bad guys still have to turn that cryptocurrency into some form of cash, of fiat currency. And that's where kind of the anonymity breaks down. And that's where companies that track the crypto transactions, that's where they're coming in and really helping law enforcement and investigators. But sorry for the long-winded answer. At the same time, you still have a lot of, for example, moving away kind of from Eastern Europe and the kind of former Soviet bloc countries, look at places like West Africa and look at a lot of these scams that are being, and I don't want to call them Nigerian scams, because I think that kind of, you know, focuses too much on Nigeria. A lot of other countries are involved in those scams as well. But a lot of that is done with other forms of currency, Cash App, Zelle, PayPal, all sorts of various means of transferring funds, even prepaid cards, etc. So fraud is still being carried out in more old-fashioned ways, if you can call, gift cards old-fashioned, and not necessarily only with cryptocurrency.
That's interesting. So there's this entire mechanism of, because there was a while there where I was thinking this cryptocurrency was really like you're like gold bullion or being traded. And there's been some discussions with regards of how it's used as a lever, as a sort of an investment lever. So a way of obtaining people, weapons, drugs, things like that with the promise of Bitcoin. And so it's almost like the last person in line has to figure out a way to translate it to cash, like you mentioned earlier. But for, you know, nation states and large organizations, criminal organizations, do you sense that they're using cryptocurrency as almost like bulk moving around asset and letting the lower levels deal with translating it to cash?
Exactly. I think that's a great point. When I was working at TRM Labs, which is a blockchain intelligence company, what the team did was we would analyze a lot of the ransomware payments that were being made. And we saw that as the payments went up to the actual organizations, groups like Conti, Lockbit, et cetera, that a lot of those funds were then being transferred to other services, to other, be it Bulletproof Hosting, be it other types of services that are providing, facilitating some of this cyber criminal activity. So essentially, it's a way to exchange funds without necessarily ever converting a lot of that stuff into cash. To some extent, that's kind of like an updated hawala system. Mm-hmm. Where funds are moved from person to person without ever actually being kind of crossing borders, et cetera. So I think that's what the more successful use of cryptocurrency is kind of almost like an accounting software. But once you're actually trying to convert it into some sort of a fiat currency, that's where people get in trouble.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned sort of like in border or, crossing borders. How would you characterize, your evolution in dealing with crime, okay, and working with law enforcement agencies over these multiple decades? And now it seems that, you mentioned earlier, for example, there's a little bit more happening collaboration. So in today's world, with all these exchange of between countries and entities and criminal organizations and the internet being borderless by definition, when you look at your role in these types of investigations, are you finding yourself, what does it look like now? Do we find ourselves just constantly collaborating with all these different agencies, and is it working, or is it adding another layer of complexity that allows the bad guys to get away? I mean, how would you characterize it today?
Both, unfortunately. But I think what one of the interesting things is that the public sector has become a lot more reliant primarily in a good way on private sector entities that can focus on threat intelligence, can focus on EDR, can focus on forensics, etc. So one of the things that back in the 2000s, one of the things that really hampered us in law enforcement was, we would have these situations where we would have the bad guy. We knew what the bad guy was going to do, and all we needed to get him was, in some cases, kind of a throwaway account at a bank that they were going to transfer funds into. But at that time, the banks were very hesitant to put themselves in that situation. And the lawyers at the banks, not the badmouth lawyers, but they would, kind of like, no, we're not opening up any accounts to transfer, illegally begotten funds into our accounts. We don't want to get into trouble. And I think now you've seen a lot more collaboration between these organizations. And I think law enforcement is getting a lot more information from the private sector. And you have this whole industry, this whole kind of cottage industry, which is focused on providing the tools that law enforcement uses. at the same time, I think you have to be very careful, as we've seen, for example, with examples like the most famous, I think, is, you know, Pegasus, which was sold to various entities, that government entities or state entities that I think by all accounts did not always use them in the interest of the public. I think there was an example where I think it was publicized that in India, for example, a lot of it was used to spy on opposition individuals, opposition parties. So there's a lot of positive that comes out of that, this collaboration, because it does give law enforcement cutting edge tools to kind of combat and the collaboration with the private sector. At the same time, I think we have to be very careful as individuals. I'm in the private sector now, and as individuals in the private sector, I think we have to be very careful about who we are willing to collaborate with. And some of the companies I've worked with in the past, I've had discussions, or we've had discussions about some of the companies that approached us wanting to gain access to the intelligence that we were collecting, or asking us to target for collections entities that we turned them down. We said, no, we don't feel like this is a legitimate target for this type of collection. And I'm proud that we did that. I think it's very important that this collaboration, there's checks and balances on both sides.
Yeah, that's important. And I think, you know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about all these various capabilities. It's almost like, you know, nuclear proliferation, right? You know, you have these cyber weapons that were limited in capability only because of the audience or the scope by which that people had control of it. And now, you know, that scope is now global. Anybody could, relatively speaking, get their hands on it, like Pegasus. And I want to start bridging into the discussion around threat intelligence, but based on what you just said, something came to mind. And I read a recent article. I wish I could remember exactly the author where I read it, but it's this kind of concept, is that the level of intelligence capabilities available to your average person or organization today, which, you know, a handful of years ago was limited to that of like the CIA and NSA or other type of, you know, intelligence agencies around the world. When you think about that, in general. So, you know, you talk about special tools for law enforcement, and we see about tools like Pegasus that are getting out of the wild, whether purposeful or not, one could argue, but these things getting out there that are being used for good and or nefarious reasons. You know, what is, in your mind, what does that look like coming from an intelligence perspective, that so there's so much available to almost anybody who has the desire and means to go collect information? You can get amazing amounts of information today, right? What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that the government is outpacing that, you know, or do we have better tools than what's available out there? I always think about this when I think when Pegasus comes up, you know.
I think one of the things that, you know, you just talked about is we do have a huge amount of information and ability and to collect the information. And unfortunately, I think one of the problems is that there's an overload. It's kind of like that old term, garbage in, garbage out. Speaking from a threat intelligence provider side, obviously we tried to find everything that was cool, everything that we thought would be helpful to our clients. And we looked at the PIRs, the primary intelligence requirements for various clients. Obviously, when you have thousands of clients, those are all tend to be a little bit different. But one of the problems was, again, that the people in the SOC, the people and the client side, a lot of times there was this overload. There was an overload of alerts. There was an overload of information coming in. You know, how do I respond to this? How do I deal with this? And I think that's really one of the problems that we're encountering now. And I think with a, you know, people talk about recession. I'm not an economist. I don't know if there's a recession or we're in a recession or a recession is coming up. I think that a lot of money is going to continue being spent on kind of cyber-enabled threat intelligence. But I think that companies have to, by definition, start figuring out where the real value is in this. They can't just throw a wide net and collect everything. There were companies that we worked with that would have three or four threat intelligence providers. And that's wonderful, but you still have that relatively small team of people who have to process all of that, all of this stuff coming at them every single day. And so it was one of those situations where more isn't always better. I think that's one of the big problems right now is figuring out what the, you know, that jargon term that I kind of hate, but it does serve a purpose, actionable intelligence. Mm-hmm. You know, what do I do about this? How do I prepare for this, et cetera? So I think that's really kind of a key thing that a lot of companies or a lot of organizations need to figure out is what can I process? What can we do? You know, it's great to have this visibility into everything, but ultimately you still have that team of individuals that somehow has to deal with it.
You know, so my thought when you were saying that is it's almost like FOMO, fear of missing out. People are like, I want it all.
Exactly.
And then they think they can filter it. Okay. But they're not able to filter it. And what I've seen a lot is not how to translate it. I'm like you, I'm not a big fan of actionable intelligence, but it is a term that works. And it is, what do I know? How can I interpret it? And then ultimately, is it playing into something I can really do something about? Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot I think I'd like to talk about threat intelligence. Okay. We can definitely go on for days. I will just start off by saying, if I may be so bold, is I've always been a threat-oriented security expert. I mean, back in the day when I got into it, we just called it security. Then it became information security, and then the wheels kept turning. But I thought, you know, security is just what you put between your assets and threats. So assets, especially in the early days, were easy to identify. You know, you could point at the server kind of thing. So it's like, well, who wants in there and why and the kind of exposures that exist. Now we're in a world where we have like the MITRE ATT&CK framework, which I think is kind of cool. We have more what I would call almost like actuarial data because folks like yourself, especially you, doing so much research in this space. So let's take a huge step back. What does threat intelligence mean to you? Because like you said earlier, I think a lot of people think they know what they're saying and think they know what it is. But what is threat intelligence? When you think about that very big term, what does it mean? How does it tie to everything that, say, for example, consumers of threat intelligence need to be thinking about? So I know that's a huge question. I apologize.
Man, if I could answer that, I'd probably be a billionaire. I'd be a selling author now. But honestly, I think it comes down to risk. It comes down to, and you've seen companies kind of shifting a little bit away from kind of what they used to call threat to risk. And because there could be a lot of different threats out there, but what is the actual risk to me, to my company, to my organization, to my entity, to my employees, et cetera. So I think the intelligence part is identifying the threats that are out there and filtering out a lot of the threats that maybe are not huge risks to us. In the finance sector, when I was working with companies that were dealing with compromised cards, it kind of amazed me because as somebody at the time was providing threat intelligence, I kind of thought, well, you want to stop every single compromised card. You want to notify every single individual whose card may have been compromised, et cetera. And I realized that in and of itself presented a huge problem for the issuers. There was a big expense. there was a loss of confidence by individuals once they found out that their credit cards may have been compromised. Maybe they didn't want to use those cards as much anymore, or they felt somehow more vulnerable. So essentially what those teams at these issuers were doing is they were trying to make that balance. What's the risk? Not every single compromised card is going to be purchased and going to be used for fraudulent activity. So what's the balance? You know, how much fraudulent activity do we have to reimburse the client for? And would it be worth for us, would it be worth it for us to actually reissue all these cards? Or does it make more sense for us to just eat some of those losses and only reissue when a specific card has been used for illegal activity, illegal purchases? And it kind of blew my mind that there are these various calculations that the company has to make around these threats and what kind of risk do those threats pose to the company. And that's really where the intelligence comes in. And You look at, for example, what is the cost here versus the cost there? What is the cost if our client's data is leaked? You see, for example, with some of the ransomware payments, some of the ransomware payments that are made these days aren't because the company can't reestablish their systems and can't get back to work in a relatively short period of time. A lot of companies do have backups, etc. They're making a calculated decision about their proprietary data or their clients' data being leaked on some of these extortion sites. And so that's really the intelligence part of it, is how do you take all the various threats that are out there, the physical threats, the fraud, supply chain threats, the insider threats. How do you take them and how do you analyze them and you figure out what is actually relevant to focus on? What is something that we have to do something about, as opposed to what's just nice to know? So to me, that's really the threat intelligence, is taking the various scary things that are out there and putting together something that you want to be aware of all of those scary things, but at the same time, you have to focus on what you're going to direct your defenses against.
You know, to be honest with you, Roman, you opened a can of worms with that one because I holistically agree. I'm very much a threat-based type of defense cyber person, right? And you know, when you mention risk, is there's these degrees that occur in there, right? So, and maybe you agree with these sort of things, and I'd like to get your version of these, right? I always keep referring back to Don Parker's book, Fighting Computer Crime, which he published, I think it was like 1998 or something. It's really old. And he talked about this concept of SCRAM, skills, knowledge, resource, access, and motive. And that was a way of sort of giving the threat almost like an identity, right? Where things like, one could argue, like the MITRE attack framework is very technical, not necessarily motivated, right? So that bridge from threat intelligence to making a business decision, where I find people struggle, and I really want to know your thought on this, is the concept of probability. Mm-hmm. And so I could say to you, you have a very capable and indiscriminate threat. For example, Conti, right? Mm-hmm. Are Evil or whatever they're called now, right? So, but there's a very different animal is if you're dealing with a specific, highly targeted type of threat scenario and you represent something. I used to use example like hacktivism, right? Mm-hmm. Because you could really quantify a target because for obvious reasons they're hacktivists. So one, do you agree that probability is a key factor in that threat intelligence? And then two, you know, how would you describe it? Because I think this is where I find people struggle is, well, yeah, if that were to happen, that'd be really bad and cost me a lot of money, or I make some sort of business decision. But then Is it really going to happen, or how often? And this becomes, you know, a very debated topic in these sessions. So what, I get your thought on how do you address those types of discussions?
No, absolutely. I think that's a really great point. And that's one of the things where kind of the threat intelligence, as we normally talk about it, like in the commercial sense, that's where it comes in. Because otherwise, you can just have alerts. You can just have an automated system that says, oh, this bad guy mentioned my company. I need to look at it. I need to focus on it. The threat intelligence comes in where an analyst looks at it and says, well, this individual just registered. They have no reputation. They have no, they're claiming some sort of ridiculous thing that is probably not, you know, not feasible, or they're selling a 0 day to Microsoft for $1,000. Chances are that, you know, that's not a legitimate threat. Chances are that's somebody, a bad guy trying to scam other bad guys out of $1,000. So I think, again, that's where you talked about motivation. You talked about the capability. And that's where I think something that we haven't been able to automate, and I don't think we ever will be able to automate, is you still have to have individuals with an understanding of the ecosystem, be it the dark web, be it the business email compromise ecosystem. You still have to understand how the people think. I think, not to make this about myself, but I think that was one of the things that made me successful as someone who didn't come out of a technical background, but my ability to understand when I started monitoring the dark web, you know, almost 20 years ago, understand how these people thought and how they operated and their interaction and their motivation, et cetera. And I think that's something that, you know, good threat intelligence providers can help the clients with, is so that you're not swimming in just oceans of automated alerts, but really, you know, who are the motivated actors? We had situations where, just a quick example, a bad guy had access to AWS keys of thousands of entities. They were not going to target all those entities. They didn't have the time, the wherewithal. They were just offering, selling access to these various things. And they were saying, hey, tell me what company you're interested in. I'll see if I have it. If I do, I'll sell it to you. So, you know, even ransomware groups, a lot of times ransomware groups are limited by the individuals they have working there who can do the negotiations, who can do all of these various things. They have access to a lot more companies. Sometimes they're inside companies for months, not only because they're studying the internal dynamics of the company. A lot of times they're in there for months just simply because they don't have time to go in and look at what's there and what they're targeting. And I think at some point, you know, just kind of a little prognosticating, I think at some point we're going to get to an area where they're not going to negotiate anymore. They're just going to send out a bill. It's going to become automated. And it's something like, okay, you guys, here's your invoice. Pay us, not pay us. It's going to be up on all that kind of stuff.
Amazing.
So, because they're literally, we see people talking about how they don't have the human capital to process all of the initial access that they have, all of the systems that they have access to. So, but that's the threat intelligence. That's what, or the good threat intelligence is to help you figure out, you know, what is an actual threat as opposed to what's just a, you know, kind of a potential threat.
That's so fascinating. You know, and sometimes, you know, it, me included, have really put threats on a high pedestal. You know, they're so far ahead, they're very capable. A lot of these things are true, of course, but, and we say, oh, they operate like a business, and you never really kind of put pen to paper and say, they're only as good as their resources and availability, right? So they're in companies for a long time because they don't have time to extract, which is really a scary thought when you think about it, right? And also what I find fascinating is, you know, you're so close to this. You're right on top of it. And I talk to a lot of people about threat intelligence. And I always find it interesting. They see it almost like a news source, like what's happening in the world of cyber. And this entire time you've been talking, really emphasizing intelligence from the perspective of interpretability. Like, is it applicable to your business? And what I find, to me, I think the distinctive twist of what separates you and the few folks that are like you've been doing for a long time is you're thinking like a criminal. You've been investigating that, and you understand how they approach certain things, right? And I think is, you know, your average law-abiding citizen is not thinking of a way to defraud another person or a bank or an organization. And so, you know, that intelligence part is, you know, a person's ability, a good threat intelligence source's ability to translate and say, this is real. It sounds terrible, but in reality, here's what it probably means. So I think is, you know, this conversation is very interesting to me because it's, we're not really talking about, you know, feeds, you know, we're really talking about what is behind these types of things that are happening. So I think is one of the things I would ask you is I made a comment recently saying that maybe the future of cybersecurity is almost going to be like, I hate to almost use this term, but almost federalized, right? Because everybody, you know, crime occurring and with cybercrime, if you will, it's becoming really rampant. It seems like it's just happening everywhere, and criminals are highly enabled. And I see law enforcement, a lot of more collaboration, like you mentioned earlier. You know, do you see cybersecurity? Everything we've also talked about is more around fraud, and that sort of orb of fraud just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Do you envision sort of a major change in how we're perceiving cybersecurity with how much threat intelligence we've gained over the last 20 years? Do you see us kind of taking a different tact to it?
I think so. I think you've seen that with some of the new agencies that have come up, you know, CISA, some of the new help that they're providing to, you know, they're much more kind of client facing than they used to be. You know, even the FBI, which wasn't always great at sharing information, they've been really good about putting out notices over the last couple of years. So they've gotten a lot better at putting out notices about specific threats because, you know, for a long time, law enforcement was very much, hey, give us information. We'll try to make a case, but there was a lot, there wasn't that feedback loop. Now you see a lot more of these notices that come out and saying, hey, this is happening. This is a threat. These are the individuals. So they're collecting and they're aggregating that data. And not to say that they're competing with threat intelligence, but they're augmenting that. And I think one of the things that, and also not everybody can afford threat intelligence. There are a lot of mom and pop shops or small to medium-sized businesses that get targeted, and them being compromised can create a lot of problems for a lot of people. At the same time, they're not companies that can, you know, just readily buy a license to a Recorded Future or CrowdStrike or et cetera. But one of the things, interesting things that I wanted to bring up is a colleague of mine recently brought up this interesting idea of kind of like we have with the EPA and the Superfund, you know, for certain disaster sites where the government does come in and it's funded by the kind of guilty industry or guilty party, but the government does come in and kind of take responsibility of dealing with something. I think that we may be in kind of on the verge of a situation where you look at what's happening with cryptocurrency, for example. There may be a situation where the government has to set up some sort of deposit or insurance like they did with banks after the Great Depression, where the government has to come in and come up with some sort of way to go in and fix things when a company goes belly up, because obviously, you know, a lot of people lost a lot of money in this instance. And something like that may need to happen with some of the ransomware operations or some of the other large be it data leak or incidents like that, where basically the government has to come in and clean up the mess that a company may not be able to handle on their own.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. I couldn't possibly agree more. And if you look at the evolution of, well, everything from the formation of government, you know, back into Greek history, all the way through to the evolution of law enforcement and the evolution of, as things become more sort of public domain from a risk perspective, as a public coming together, representative government, and at least in our case, is governments get involved in sort of providing that. Look at, you know, national health care that, you know, we've branched out into in the U.S. some years ago. Obviously, you know, you've got NHS in the U.K. and other sort of nation-based healthcare things. One could argue there's a healthcare component there. And if you look at things like cyber insurance companies, they're reevaluating what they're going to cover moving forward because of the potential systemic scenarios like cloud that can affect multiple scenarios. And yeah, I agree. I think, I'd be very curious to see what it looks like, but those are a couple of things I never even thought of. Certainly. I just know I sense something is coming in that way. Mm-hmm. And I think, if I may be so bold, is, you know, I remember the very early days of regulation, you know, like HIPAA and all that kind of stuff in the late 90s. And yes, maybe some progress, but let's be honest, now you just sign a HIPAA statement when you go to the hospital. That's it. You know, you know, it's almost like checkbox stuff. It's not necessarily reducing, you know, actual risk. So I know, man, there is just so much more, Roman. We've got to find another time. I know you have some really amazing stories, and we talk about that before we turn the mics on. Talk about doing that. So, I'd ask you is two, I guess, one tactical question, and then one final question for you. Right, tactically is, when you mention like small businesses and organizations that can't afford threat intelligence, or more importantly, let's be honest, every company that's absorbing threat intelligence, they still have to make it about them. Yep. And be able to interpret that, right? What do you think is the future of threat intelligence? Are you going to see more customized, like going into organizations and learning more about them, their profile, how they interpret risk, and then tuning information to them? Or is that already happening? I don't see it personally, but maybe you're saying that is already happening, or is that the future?
No, I think that's a great example or a great question. And I wanted to kind of go back for a second to something you said before. You mentioned the word holistic. And I think that's super important because right now I think cyber, unfortunately, lives off on its own a lot of times. And it doesn't, you know, there is, in a sense, you could say there is no cyber threat. All of these various threats are enabled by the internet. They're enabled by cyber capabilities. It's all fraud. It's all insider threat. It's all physical threat. It's, you know, hacktivism, all these various things. They're essentially the same types of crime, but they're enabled or facilitated by the connectedness to the internet that maybe we didn't have 30, 40 years ago. So I think that the idea is that cyber should be embedded with all of these various entities that handle physical threat, that handle at an organization, that handle all of those various other risks. But going back to the question you just asked, I think there are some really interesting companies that I've recently been speaking with, and they do kind of go into your tech stack. They go into the reality of you as an entity, and they say, okay, so for example, if a bad guy was to go in and get access to your system, then based on what you have right now, whether it's pen testing, whether it's there's another term, deceptive, something or other, I can't think of it right now. But essentially, they're looking at, they say, okay, the bad guy if they go in, this is what they're going to do. This is where they're going to go. So imagine you have a house and a criminal breaks into the house. They're going to take a look at your house and they're going to say, okay, the safe is probably over here. Let me go this way. They're probably not going to go into the kitchen and or in the bathroom or in these various other places. So essentially, that's what some of these companies are doing, is they're customizing so that the overworked SOC or the security professionals can say, okay, we don't have to look at every single possibility that could happen, but we can look at what is the digital footprint of our company. This is maybe how they will access our company. What is the tech stack of our company? So if they have access, they're going to go here. They're going to make a right turn here. They're going to make a left turn here. They're going to do this and do that. And I think that really helps, again, the overworked individuals try to figure out where to focus most of their efforts.
You know, I think as you're talking about that and explaining is, I think that could be a huge business opportunity, if I'm blunt, because there's, you said it at the very beginning of the show, is that there's this overwhelming amount of information, especially today, mm-hmm. right? I mean, it's just coming from all directions. And I think I'm really glad that you went back to the point about cyber is just an enabler. It's still the same thing. And I think for those of us who've been in this rodeo for a while, we see it. And we're even using, we throw hack or cyber in front of something like hack, you know, hacktivism, right? Okay. By very nature, it's activism in the form of hacking, right? So we see it, we sense it. But now I think everybody's starting to come to grips with the fact that the digital environment is now officially completely infused with who we are as a society. And we have to address it. So I guess, before I ask you the final question, I make one statement, though, is unlike physical traditional crime, where we have established law enforcement and agencies and militaries, dare I say, to deal with these kind of things, now companies are now currently taking responsibility for cyber-enabled crime. So you almost envision SOCs as an example at Google or Microsoft or Cisco or pick some giant company. These are really almost like enforcement agencies that are funded by a private entity. That's why I was saying, is I use that term federalized earlier, because I really do believe very deeply in what you said. I think it's brilliant, is that it's crime enabled by cyber and it shouldn't be separated. And I think I 100% support that. So the last thought I would have you share is, I think ultimately, is what would you recommend to somebody? What's your ultimate advice for people that are consuming threat intelligence? And then maybe share your ideas on people who would be interested in getting into threat intelligence, because I see a lot of people wanting to do threat intelligence and I start seeing it. It's like, well, it almost looks like a news feed, you know, maybe give your advice to companies looking at threat intelligence. You don't have to mention products or any of that kind of stuff, maybe just key aspects. And then maybe some advice for people who are looking to get into becoming intelligence specialists.
Sure. So if you're thinking about becoming an intelligence specialist, I say go for it. I think there's a need. There's definitely need for individuals to be out there, individuals who have good analytical skills. I think technical knowledge is incredibly helpful. I think it's wonderful. I know some brilliant people who can reverse things that just would, you know, I look at it and my eyes glaze over. And so I think that's super important. At the same time, I think one of the things that we sometimes try to cheat a little bit is we try to automate the stuff too much. We try to focus on kind of the silver bullet and say, okay, we'll turn on this control and they'll take care of everything. The weak link most of the time is still a human being. No matter how many controls you put out there, you see it now, there's been a resurgence in social engineering. You know, as we make it more difficult to break into systems because we harden the systems, people will just continue targeting, or criminals will continue targeting the better nature of individuals. And I think that's something that we have to focus on. And I was at a company that shall remain nameless that, you know, they had a little automated tutorial about how not to fall victim to phishing and all of that kind of stuff. And a lot of people laughed at it. Hey, we're in cybersecurity. We're not going to fall for this. We're not going to. Guess what? I've fallen for various things, and I've been doing this for 20 years. And social engineering is not a technical issue. It's not because I didn't realize how this worked or that worked. I know how social engineering works. And sometimes you still freak out because the whole point is it's kind of like that old British, you know, saying, keep calm and carry on. Well, that's how you have to respond. That's kind of my one advice to everybody who's, you know, who wants to help prevent cyber threat is if you get a crazy email saying that, you know, somebody just stole $1 million from you or somebody wants to give you $1 million. Don't freak out because that's exactly what the threat actors are counting on. The sense of urgency, the sense of your boss needs something from you immediately. You know, there's been some sort of a horrible hack in your system, you know, hack in quotes, and you need to deal with it right away or else you and the whole team will be fired, etc. Don't respond. Don't react. I'm sorry. Shouldn't say don't respond. Don't react the way they want you to react. And I think that's really the key, is to essentially, we can't forget the human factor in security, in all types of security. We really have to continue to focus on education. We have to continue to focus on, you know, making it easier for individuals to make the right decision. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of it. I think we have to, not to say that we can't, we have to continue improving our security and our EDR, et cetera. At the same time, we're never going to get to the point where slightly off tangent, but we were just talking to someone the other day about, you know, kids and adults texting and driving, you know, and you, you know, you show the movies and you do all these kinds of things, but until there's fully automated vehicles that drive by themselves, all vehicles drive by themselves, we're always going to have that risk of somebody making a bad decision. And the same thing, no matter how much we defend and protect, until things are completely automated, which I don't know, I would want that, but there's still people that are going to be apt to make a bad decision or a mistake, and we have to continue working on minimizing that, on educating, on providing, you know, two factors that are easy to use but still secure, so that you don't just kind of click on a button just to stop them spamming you, and then, as happened recently with Lapsus and stuff like that. Yeah, sorry. I kind of went off on a tangent.
No, but, not at all.
But yeah, I think that's really what we have to focus on is right now cyber is still kind of out there and people still think of some cyber nerds or cyber geeks that are handling all of this stuff. And cyber, just like I said before, cyber has to be part of everything. It has to be everybody's responsibility to be careful. Like, when you're leaving a business, you want to close the door behind you. That's not the security staff's responsibility, whether the last, you know, person that left. That's the last person knows that they have to close and lock the door after they leave their business. That's the same thing that we have to really get to the point where people understand that cybersecurity is everybody's responsibility.
Absolutely. And I think your point about texting and driving is fantastic because I believe in people's ability. I think one of the things that where we may have failed is we haven't engaged people's true interests. You know, we have these like intensely boring, you know, awareness programs and stuff like that. But then again, no matter how good you are, there's always going to be somebody who's going to text and drive sooner or later. And so we have to have the controls. But I do believe, like you're right, we have to keep elevating and cyber on its own has not worked. It really, things have gotten worse. And so we have to really start thinking more broadly about it and in every possible way. I can't begin to thank you enough. And for everybody listening, now you know why I want to have like three more shows with Roman. We would really get into it, man.
It'd be my pleasure.
I again, deepest thank you from my heart. And I think we have so much more to talk about.
We haven't even got to this information. So
we haven't got to this information yet. What are you going to do? Well, again, thank you again. And thank you to everybody who's listening. And we'll see you next time on Security Bites.